Morning glory and evening grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Aloha. I'm broadcasting today from 690 in Hawaii, The Answer, and I'm so glad to be here all week long. Thank you for joining me. I have my eyes on the headlines out of Australia. 17 hostages were sprung. Only two were killed in the course of the operation overnight in Sydney, Australia. Man Haron Monis is a 50-year-old self-proclaimed sheikh, was also killed in that, Iranian-born Islamist. I'll keep you posted as headlines come out of that. No, I'm not going to spend any time on Johnny Football's terrible appearance yesterday. Those of you who are looking backwards should be looking forward. Or much on the Senate meltdown over the weekend, though. I'm going to be talking about Ted Cruz because today I'm joined for the entire show by my friend Richard Norton Smith, whom many of you hear every President's Day in a show that we taped years ago talking about all the presidents. Richard, of course, is the extraordinarily gifted presidential historian and a biographer of Thomas Dewey and Robert McCormick, as well as Herbert Hoover and George Washington. He is the official historian of C-SPAN. He's been my friend of 40 years. And Richard, welcome. It's great to speak to you about your brand new book, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. Good to have you.
Well, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. This is a terrific book. And I'm going to quote Nelson Rockefeller on page 255 of your book.
As a rule.
No, I don't. But I wrote this down as soon as I saw it. The best way to read a book is to get an author to tell you about it. But dyslexia is at the heart of this book. And I think that's one of the reasons he liked to talk about books with authors.
And it's one of those humanizing details that he shied away from, you know, during his lifetime. He was of that generation of men. He's a classic illustration of how the very rich get the worst medical treatment.
Yes.
You know, he had this osteopath who was a sidekick, and I think an occasional procurer. Nelson probably would not have died when he did if he'd had a different medical regimen. But dyslexia was something, it's interesting, because it did shape his life in ways that were profound. He never heard the word until he was 50 years old. It's interesting, doing a life of Nelson Rockefeller, it's not your conventional political biography.
But it is a biopic of the 20th century.
Well, it's funny. There are so many disciplines that you have to master. I mean, not only abstract expressionist art, you know, of the New York school, but dyslexia, the history of dyslexia, which, in fact, the name really didn't come into common usage until the middle of the 20th century. He went through life thinking he had a deficient IQ. And his mother, who was, you know, just this remarkable woman, the pivot in a lot of ways of his own personality. She told him, you know, surround yourself with people who are smarter than you. And he did. And the interesting thing is, we'll never know. But on balance, I think it was probably a negative. If you're running for president, it's great if you've got a Jim Farley or a Louis Howe or Karl Rove. But Nelson, because of the resources at his command, could have 20 or 30 of those, which, of course, made them all essentially worthless. What he didn't do was listen to his own gut, which, according to the people who I talked to, and I did about 150 interviews, was actually a whole lot better than most of the paid gurus.
Well, I want to let people know the 140 interviews went over 14 years. This is an epic piece of work, and I want to begin by saying
there are people who would say Nelson was an epic piece of work.
Well, he was, or as Happy said at the end, he was a great guy. I wish I'd known. I never met Rockefeller.
Yeah.
And despite the Nixon Association, the Reagan Association, he just wasn't around. We never crossed paths, so I never saw him in person even. But you begin the book, and I want to point this out, with a dedication for Brian Lamb and the C-SPAN family. And I want to echo that. So many books and authors would never get any attention but for the fact of their weekend work and their love of books. And so
true. And indeed, shall I say, reading itself, which in the age of Twitter has at least been altered. And, Brian and those, because he would be, you know, it's interesting. In 35 years, You've never heard Brian Lamb use his own name on C-SPAN?
No, interesting.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
What does that tell you about the corporate culture? You know, it's just a, you know, it's a time capsule in a whole lot of ways. And thank God for it, because as you say, there's this great respect for the intelligence and the curiosity.
Oh, curiosity. You know, let me go there. Here's a small list of things I had not known about Rockefeller.
Yeah.
He saved the old executive office building. Richard Parsons was a Rocky protege. Rockefeller was said to be the inspiration for George Grisby in the 1948 The Lady from Shanghai.
Yeah,
he tried to save the Dodgers from leaving Brooklyn.
Yeah.
He got Article 51 into the UN Charter and the UN into Manhattan, and he knew that Hiss was working for the Soviets in 47. He had an obsession with fallout shelters. I didn't know about Salvador Agron. He invented, in a way, supply-side economics. LBJ loved his wife. How's my girlfriend happy? The Taylor Law, pure water, the Rocky Commission with Reagan during VP, the Rule 22 filibuster stuff, Richard.
Oh, I know. It's astonishing. His fingerprint. This is the irony. You know, the reviews have been for the most part, very generous. And those who have stepped back and seen him as he's kind of a Zelig. You know, I mean, he's in the picture throughout.
Oh, a Zelig with power, though.
You know, he's 30. Yeah, but he's an activist. He's not just in the picture. He's 32 years old when FDR gives him a continent, you know, South America,
yes,
to play with. He's already helped his father build Rockefeller Center, and by the way, rent Rockefeller Center. I mean, he was a businessman before he was a politician or public servant or professional liberal or whatever you want to call him. And of course, he had really made the survival of his mother's museum, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, possible.
I am going to talk at length with Richard today. Richard Norton Smith is my guest, about his brand new book, On His Own Terms, which is linked over at HughHewitt.com, This Life of Nelson Rockefeller. It is the perfect Christmas present. It is also, as I have told at least a half dozen people over the last 2 weeks involved in the 2016 election, essential reading for the Republican primary. It is almost, it's like a cracked mirror image of what is going on right now in the Republican Party, and we'll talk about that. But I have to pay you the ultimate compliment, Richard. As I was flying over, I'm in Hawaii today, I flew over with Fetching Mrs. Hewitt yesterday, and I read straight for 6 hours. I'd finished about two-thirds of the book before I got on the plane and finished it off and made my outline. But I burst into laughter, the kind of laughter that is embarrassing, on page 423, a footnote about Dolores Bridges, Norris Cotton, and Richard Kleindienst, which I had never read, which we cannot talk about on the air.
Well, we could talk about it, we just can't precisely quote it. I'm not sure it would have the same impact.
I don't think it would.
You are not the first person to call attention. A week ago, I was in Manchester, New Hampshire, at the up there at St. Anselm's College. They have this wonderful political institute, which, of course, is grounded in the long tradition of the New Hampshire primary. And without naming names, someone there, first thing they said was exactly what you, because, of course, Dolores is part of the New Hampshire political lore. But
people need to go into the bookstore and just pick up On His Own Terms. If you don't even buy it, just go to page 423 and read the footnote.
I'm pleasantly surprised to hear that you read it all the way through. I was afraid that most people would read the last chapter first.
Oh, no. Oh, and I think what I said earlier, do you agree with me that if you are a serious student of 20s, I told this to a National Journal reporter this morning.
Yeah.
Youngster, 28-year-old, not a youngster, professional.
Yeah.
And he wanted to talk to me about Ted Cruz and a dinner we had for Ted on the West Coast and all this sort of stuff. And I said, you bet I'll talk about the senator, but you need to go read On His Own Terms, because 64...
Yeah.
40 years later is playing out again. What do you think? Or 50 years later?
I think so, too. In fact, it's funny you mention that, because I did an essay not long ago for Time in which I actually personalized it through Justin Amash, the libertarian,
Michigan,
civil libertarian congressman from Gerald Ford's old congressional district, who has become, for better and worse in many ways, the face of the younger Republican Party, and certainly the libertarian element of the Republican Party. I think it's just as the Goldwater movement was bigger than Goldwater, and they were perfectly prepared. For example, the original choice was John Tower. They thought, you know, let's nominate Tower, and well, that wasn't going to happen. And Goldwater was a reluctant draftee, as you know. But in any event, the Goldwater movement was always bigger than Goldwater. It was about a belated reckoning, if you will, with the, particularly the South and the West, the evolving conservative, quasi-libertarian, certainly anti-statist Republican Party.
A reckoning that is back. We have to take a break. Richard Norton Smith is with me throughout today's program on his own terms. His link to HughHewitt.com. Don't go anywhere. We're going to talk about Ted Cruz, Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, and Nelson Rockefeller when we come back. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt broadcasting today from Honolulu, Hawaii on AM 690, The Answer, where I'll be all week. The Senate's getting ready to break. Thank goodness the end of the 113th Congress is in sight. The Senate announced a new committee makeup next year. Our friend Tom Cotton has been named Armed Services, Intelligence, and Banking, which is terrific. Our friend Cory Gardner has been named to Foreign Affairs and Commerce, which is terrific. Things are looking very good. But I also have my eye on politics. Ted Cruz made some more enemies and a lot more friends this weekend. And I note, just 4 minutes ago, Philip Rucker of The Washington Post tweeted out, Republicans here in South Carolina say Jeb Bush needs to adapt. Jeb can remake that brand. You can have a new Coke. Ted made all these different enemies, and Eliana Johnson has a great story on him over at nationalreview.com. And I'm looking at Tim Alberta's story from a couple of months ago about Chris Christie. Chris Christie previews 2016 campaign. It's time to start offending people. I don't care if I'm loved. I want to be respected. My guest is Richard Norton Smith, eminent historian, watcher of all things political, no stranger himself to the clash of presidential politics, longtime advisor to Robert Dolan, administrator of presidential libraries across the land. If you watch C-SPAN, you'll know Richard. I've known Richard for 40 years. 40 years ago, he led a bus trip of young Harvard College students down to Washington, D.C., which had there been iPhones then, had we been able to record his description of Bridgeport, had we gone as we drove through it, he would have been permanently banned from the city, I believe. But Richard, you know,
I'm still
these
eating bus tours, you know.
Yes, I do. Over at your website, people can sign up.
Yeah, it's crazy. Anyway, if anyone is curious, we're doing a couple historical tours next year. Just go to richardnortonsmith.net. Pretty simple.
You know what I would do, Richard? If you lead one around Manhattan, having read this biography of Nelson Rockefeller.
You know what? It's funny. I've got a trip in my mind. It's called Rockefellers and Roosevelts.
Oh, I'll go.
Wouldn't that be great?
I'll go. But just Manhattan, because someone who's grown up in Ohio and spends most of his life on the West Coast, I go to Manhattan a lot, but I didn't know Rockefeller Center. I didn't know the UN story. I didn't know the bridges story, the mayors, and you put it all into this book.
Well, you know, and the funny thing, of course, the UN building, that's important. And, of course, there are generations of New Yorkers who have been stuck in traffic jams who have silently cursed Nelson for his role. But much, much more important and much less well-known is what he did at the organizing meeting of the UN
in
San Francisco.
Article 51.
Exactly. It was Nelson Rockefeller who stood up to his own country's delegation, and needless to say, that of the Soviet Union, with the backing of his Latin American allies, and they amended the UN Charter with, as you say, Article 51. Article 51 says very simply that the UN will authorize, recognize regional defensive alliances. In other words, the Security Council is not going to be, as was originally envisioned, a kind of supra-global government. What that practically led to was NATO. A few years later, John Foster Dulles, who was furious at Rockefeller at the time of the conference, sat next to him at a dinner. He said, you know, I owe you an apology. If it hadn't been for Article 51, you know, we wouldn't have NATO. And imagine the history of the Cold War without NATO or similar alliances. So, I mean, that's just one of those
amazing details. Also, in your narrative, which I did not know. He had spotted Hiss as a communist in 47. Yeah. I like to spoof young journalists when they come on. I ask them, was Alger Hiss a communist? And they often don't know who Alger Hiss was. But, of course, it's the fault line of American politics, and Rocky knew.
You know, the funny thing, Rockefeller was Stu Spencer, who needs no introduction to you, you know, the great political strategist who is best known for his work with Ronald Reagan.
And his wheel wagon party may be happening today, for all I know, but go ahead.
It's just a wonderful, wonderful guy. Anyway, Stu said of all the people he'd ever worked with, Nelson Rockefeller was by far the most militant anti-communist.
Yep.
Bill Buckley told the story about Rockefeller saying, look, at heart, I'm a conservative. No one has more to conserve than I do. So he was this odd combination. One reason why he's tough to kind of label is he was in favor of fallout shelters, but he was in favor of foreign aid. You know, he was an enlightened anti-communist. And, you know, we have trouble, I think, finding a pigeonhole.
Well, you know, Richard, as I concluded this, and I was thinking about him last night, because you had sent me an email earlier, what do you think? Is he still the center-right conservative? Because of his belief in study groups and his studiousness, he would have come to understand that big government doesn't work. He said, as you said memorably, said of Hugh Carey, he got to drink the champagne, Rockefeller, and Carey got the hangover.
Also, you know, there's a trajectory here. You know, after all, this is a life story, and none of us, you know, he was governor of New York for 15 years.
It is remarkable.
I mean, I defy anyone to be unchanged, you know, whatever their experience of life in 15 years. And there is no doubt that in his last years, he became more, quote, conservative. He became, he recognized that he had pushed to the limits and perhaps beyond what a state, even a rich state like New York, could do on its own. You know, in the mid-60s, New York State was spending more money to fight water pollution than the federal government was in 50 states.
I want to read from page 673. Again, this is On His Own Terms, Richard Norton Smith, brand new biography of Rockefeller and his age, which is available. I've linked it over at hughhewitt.com. By any standard of measurement, you write, Richard, the tangible results of his governorship were historic. The state university expanded from 38,000 to 244,000 students, 55 new state parks, 109 hospitals and nursing homes, 200 water treatment plants, trails blazed in funding the arts, protecting the consumer, restoring the environment, and advancing transportation, human rights, highway safety, and a dozen other causes that led to political and policy analyst Neil Pierce, in his highly regarded 1972 work, The Megastates of America, to label Rockefeller the most remarkable and innovative of the post-war governors. And I served 10 years on the California Arts Council. I didn't know that was Rocky that started that whole thing.
Yeah, the first state arts council in America. And you know, but the great test came 10 years later when New York really had its first significant fiscal crisis under Rockefeller. And, of course, the first thing that everyone wanted to cut was the arts council. For obvious reasons. And it was, he was adamant. He was absolutely adamant. And he was not an eloquent man. You know, the dyslexia played havoc with his ability to read a speech. But he was very good off the cuff. And things he cared about, and he cared about the arts, and he cared about culture. And he believed that, you know, this is not, you know, legislators make jokes about one of his associates said the only reason they got the state arts council was they traded judges
for ballet dancers.
You know?
That was a great line.
It is a good line. But for Rockefeller, it went to the heart of who we are. And particularly in this fragmented culture of ours, it's our common culture, our uncommon common culture, you know, that he thought was deserving of support.
So what does 1960, 1964, and 1968 have to tell us in 2014 and through 2016? A lot. Don't go anywhere. Richard Norton Smith, my ebullient guest, has got a wonderful new book out, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. I've linked it at hughhewitt.com. Whoever you give it to will thank you repeatedly because it's addictive, riveting, and awfully entertaining. 34 minutes after the hour, America. Chu Hewitt, eyes on the headlines as always. As any more additional news out of Australia will emerge, as you know, two were killed and the terrorist also shot in Sydney over the weekend. But they're continuing to be very, very careful in Australia. I'll keep my eye on that. My guest this whole day is Richard Norton Smith. It's a Christmas present to you because Richard is much beloved by this audience and everyone who watches him C-SPAN. He is really the most entertaining of conversationalists about all matters of American politics and history. And if you want to do anyone a favor, anyone who is at all interested in American politics, go over to HughHewitt.com or to a local bookstore and pick up this brand new biography of the life of Nelson Rockefeller. It's really, as I said at my website, a biopic of the 20th century. The book is titled On His Own Terms. You know, Richard, it was absolutely eerie reading about Attica, or even if you go back to Salvador Agron, the Cape Man, and all the way through the civil rights marchers and his bailing out the protesters in Selma and all this stuff against the backdrop of Michael Brown and Eric Gardner and what Nelson thought was a bubbling up of really the political sensibility of the time. It's sort of a replay of that too.
It is. It's amazing. You know, I have, I don't know about you, but I have come to realize more profoundly, I guess, in recent years. As a kid, I mean, I remember I was 9 years old watching the March on Washington and watching Bull Connor's police dogs, you know, and the water hoses in Birmingham, like so many Americans. And I was an odd child and annoyingly precocious and very interested in public affairs and so on. And if there was ever a time when literally, there were good guys and bad guys, that was it. And it's all these years later, I have to tell you, there are days when I'm appalled. It seems as if things that I thought we'd settled 50 years ago are not settled. I mean, language that I thought I would never hear again, you know, assumptions that I thought had been effectively disproved.
Well, what's that quote that Rockefeller had? He'd been buried so often, he always used it as a rest time. We always think some issues are buried and they come back out of the grave. But just this weekend in your hometown of Boston, the protesters marched to the jail where they chanted back and forth to the inmates. And you've got a terrific description of Attica. For anyone who doesn't know anything about it, that's worth the book itself. But you wonder if the same kind of cycle isn't going to happen. And I put the book down at one point thinking, gosh, I wonder if this unrest is going to travel into the prisons.
Yeah, you know, that's a fascinating point. I will tell you, the Attica chapter, I thought the last chapter would be the hardest to write. But no, the chapter on Attica was the hardest because, you know, one reason this took 14 years was because it isn't simply for a biographer learning new things. Equally important is unlearning all the sorts of things you thought you knew, you took for granted. And Attica has entered, you know, the realm of legend.
And, Al Pacino. Yep.
And yeah, absolutely, Al Pacino. For a whole generation, you know, it's Al Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon. And the fact is, this was the first time that the Rockefeller perspective had been incorporated, not to the exclusion of the others. I mean, that's what makes the chapter, I think, first of all, what made it so difficult to do was to try to credibly, authentically, without a bias one way or the other, recreate what is a very complicated story.
It's great storytelling. And let me give you, and as I was reading this, the Sydney hostage thing was going down.
Yeah, oh, well.
And you pointed out, had they kept going on the first day of Attica, they might have averted the massacre. Yeah. Well, and they had no medical personnel around. I mean, there are stories.
You see, you just put your fingers on the problem. Over the years, people have understandably tended to conflate Rockefeller's refusal to go to Attica to join the, quote, negotiations, although, frankly, you know, when you're talking about the likes of William Kunstler and others as
Bobby Seale
observers, they were not exactly negotiations, with TV cameras to boot. I mean, it's almost a Paddy Chayefsky script, you know, waiting to be filmed. But the fact is, you could argue both ways. I think he should have gone, but I understand why he didn't go. Okay. The problem was, people have conflated that with the horribly botched retaking of the prison the next day, when, as you say, there was no apparent preparation against the contingencies, including, you know, in the end, the death of over 30 people.
As opposed to last night in Australia, they had all the medical services on site in Sydney outside of the restaurant so that when the storming of the hostage situation happened, they got as many people to... that's why reading On His Own Terms is so relevant to everyone. It's like every chapter is that way. I'll be right back with Richard Norton Smith. Don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Five minutes after the hour, America, to Hewitt. It is a shameless radio tease, but I'm going to postpone the conversation about 2016 until next hour. This is the short segment, Richard Norton Smith. So it's 3 minutes. I just want to bring up one more eerie moment. I did not realize that the 44 segment. I mean, it's I did not realize that Nelson Rockefeller chaired the commission investigating the CIA for Gerry Ford, and Ronald Reagan was on it post the Colby Report. And here we are this week, last week, all the CIA scandals are coming out, and I'm thinking back, I wonder if anyone's dusted off the Rockefeller report.
Of course, the irony is Rockefeller didn't want to do it.
Right.
Rockefeller was convinced. In fact, at one point, there's an amazing scene where he refuses to accept a letter from the President of the United States outlining, you know, in some detail exactly what he wants, because Rockefeller convinced himself that he was being set up. And he always pointed the finger at Don Rumsfeld, his, you know, bête noir in the Ford White House. He believed that he was being set up to take the fall when the word leaked out that the CIA was, in fact, somehow involved in the Kennedy assassination. I mean, really strange.
It's eerie. It's just eerie. There's one detail in the book that is simply, you just mentioned Rummy, who's been a frequent guest on the program. Yes. So I want to bring up Dick Cheney. The vice president's been on a lot as well. And I worked for Lynn Cheney. There's a 1976 convention anecdote in which Rockefeller's screaming at Cheney, and you say Lynn Cheney is reduced to tears. I can't believe that. I can't imagine.
That was my reaction as well. in fact, that's the universal reaction. People who believe everything else in the book, really, they have trouble swallowing that. It does give you an idea of how bad it must have been.
Did you ever ascertain to your own benefit whether or not the convention handlers had turned down Rockefeller's microphones on purpose?
No. And in fact, but I talked to people who had the same experience he had, who could not hear him. But I've also talked to people who insisted that, you know, nothing of the sort was done. Who knows? That what we do know is, I say, we can talk about this later, he didn't age well. And he had a lot of resentments banked up by that night. And unfortunately, they all came pouring out when he was told his role at the end of the convention and the tableau on the in front of the convention hall was to escort Bob Dole's mother.
Yeah.
And he just lost it. And unfortunately, he pointed his anger at Dick Cheney.
You know, but you've just reminded me, at another point where he encountered someone else's mother, he won somebody over. I can't remember what that one
was. Oh, Al D'Amato.
There you go. Al D'Amato.
My mother hated him until she met him. And what he did is he said, you have a son who's graduating from a law school? And D'Amato said, from then on, she was, you know, in love with a guy.
You know, that's one of the things that comes through, a lesson for every elected official out there, how to do retail politics. It's abundant on every page.
Well, it helped if you like people.
Did Rockefeller like them, or did he just know he had to like them?
You know what? It's a combination. He liked them. Remember, imagine yourself a Rockefeller, okay? And you're looking over the wall at the rest of the world. And part of you wants to be suspicious because you're told everyone wants something from you. I mean, it was a real act of will and, yes, of faith on his part to climb over the wall and venture out and, in effect, expose himself to that. But it's because he inherited that from his mother.
You know, there's this movie out right now about John DuPont. And how his mother had to.
Good.
Yeah, it's wonderful. His mother had to buy him friends, had to rent him friends. And there's one part in On His Own Terms where Rockefeller reflects upon the fact that when you're really wealthy, you never know who your friends are. And that is very destructive of intimacy.
And that was very uncharacteristic of him. A, he was, you know, politicians are not by nature reflective. and he was no exception to that rule. But he, again, he didn't want people to know about the dyslexia. He didn't want anything that might be interpreted as a sign of weakness. And certainly, you know, complaining about the fact that, I mean, he had nothing to complain about, let's put it that way.
No. A good Baptist never lies, page 486. We have Baptists in Ted Cruz and Scott Walker, both PKs, right? Pastor's kids running. But you are obviously a philanderer. By the way, funny story on the sword that was presented to him. Very funny story.
Wonderful story. He's a big Republican gathering, Westchester County. The head of the dinner presents him with this gorgeous glass sculpture of Excalibur. And Rockefeller starts laughing in front of everyone. 1,000 people. And he can't stop. And then he says, are you telling me in front of my neighbors that I'm a great swordsman?
Yeah. So he's a great, but he's not really religious, is he?
You know what? That's a great question. I asked Happy Rockefeller that question. And I got the same response I got from someone else who was very close to him. When he lost his son, Michael, remember?
It's the saddest part of the book.
Yeah. He came back and he just said, I hope Michael meets mother in heaven.
My wife would take the book from me at points where I told her about things, and she was aware. I was unaware that Michael Rockefeller had died in New Guinea. I'd never heard the story, Richard. Didn't know
really?
It.
Really? Yeah.
And she said,
and the great tragedy was that was the child he was closest to. That was the child in whom he had invested all of his dynastic hopes.
Let me tell you, the one thing that stuck out, the Yellowstone watching the car go over the canyon, Pike's Peak train ride running out of control, a plane through the wall of a Lima airport as you land, putting Lawrence in through the fog to get his appendix out,
getting on the Hindenburg. What he thought, he said that was the scariest experience of his life. But Eddie Rickenbacker. How'd you like to ride the Hindenburg with Eddie Rickenbacker?
Only to be told we got to get the hell off of this thing. but Michael, of all those things, the thing that I thought would have stopped him would have been Michael Rockefeller's death.
Yeah, he was a classic stoic. And he went through life. And in some ways, I think it cut him off from people. And in some ways, it's only now. You know, someone close to him told me at the beginning of this, 14 years ago, they said, Nelson Rockefeller was a 16-slice pizza pie, and no one except Happy had access to more than 2 or 3 slices. And now I know what he meant.
Well, when we come back in our short segment, I want to find out about the 14 years and whether or not you ever thought of putting it aside. Because Richard Norton Smith once told me he would never write a biography of Richard Nixon because he was afraid he'd never finish it. He'd fall in and wouldn't get out. I don't know how you got out of Rockefeller. I don't. So don't go anywhere, America, except over to HughHewitt.com. The book is On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. It is just out now on the bestseller list. It's going to sell like hotcakes. If you don't know what to get somebody, get them this book. Because whether they are young or old or in between, they will either relive their lives or look forward into politics in only the way that a life as political as Nelson Rockefeller's could prepare them. Don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. 55 minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Is Ted Cruz Barry Goldwater, or is he Ronald Reagan? Is Chris Christie a new Nelson Rockefeller without the hundreds of millions of dollars? Is Mitt Romney a much more balanced and winsome Richard Nixon? All that and more coming up in the next 2 hours with Richard Norton Smith, the author of On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller, which is going to be the most talked about book in D.C. and among at least Republicans, I think, and probably anyone who cares about American history. But my question that I alluded to, Richard, and you mentioned it earlier, 14 years you've been working on this. In my whole life, I once read one book on modern art, Jackson Pollock biography, because Leanne Sappy was a lifeguard who loved modern art, and I was trying to get a date. So I read a book about Jackson Pollock. I don't know how you could have accomplished it. I mean, did you almost come close to quitting ever?
The biographer has to be open to all sorts of experiences. There's no doubt about it. I actually find it less offensive or off-putting. I'm not sure what word you're after.
Non-engaging. Not modern art so much as just the overwhelming task of understanding a person as complicated as Nelson Rockefeller.
Well, you know, Rockefeller actually talked about, because of course he had a press secretary in his first term who said the American people will never elect a president who collects Picasso. And, you know, that may have actually been the most profound thing that anyone around Rockefeller said.
Yeah.
And people
yeah.
were always asking him. Now, remember, he's dyslexic.
Oh.
And he would tell reporters, you reporters, you're word people. You're word people. You want everything explained in words. You want spelled out. See, to a dyslexic, abstract expressionist art is an alternate language of sorts. He said it expanded your mind. I don't know what that means.
I just got to know.
Something to do with his dyslexia.
I want to make sure people understand. You cover warts and all. I just got a note from Grant Sterrett, a young friend who loved the Wall Street Journal Review about Rocky wanting to set up a meeting with Thomas Aquinas. So you're not.
Yeah. Well. Do we have time to tell a story? Or?
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal told the story that you told in reviewing your book. Grant Sterrett read the review. By the way, has it been widely and well reviewed? This could be I think this is a Pulitzer book. What's the reaction?
Actually, it's been very well reviewed. One exception, there was a pissy review in the Times and the New York Review of Books, which doesn't exactly come as a surprise.
A shock.
Neither, shall we say, appreciated Rockefeller as a historical figure. They were determined to look at the Rockefeller in contemporary terms. They look around as a journalist does, you know, and they say, well, where's the tangible evidence of his continuing political influence?
Oh, my gosh. When we come back, we're going to talk about that, because he exposed and lived the seam in the Republican Party, which remains so vibrant today and may, in fact, condemn us to another 64 or maybe to another 1980. We don't know. We'll be right back with Richard Norton Smith to discuss, on his own terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller, linked at QDoIt.com.